I still say things like, yeah, you know, we tape that every week. It's like, I'm sure there's going to be some point where somebody will go, what's tape? You know?
Like Scotch tape or what?
Yeah, I was going to say, you remember those big old reel-to-reels, you know? The big TAC machines and,
And
now it's all digital.
Yeah,
that's right. Everything I say is converted to little ones or zeros, right?
Right.
It's a binary world. Last week we finished up, we got through Ephesians 6, we ended Ephesians 6, 9. Which ended the relationship section that started in 5 that talked about the relationship between men and women, parents and children, and slaves and masters, and I said that that's more applicable to employers and employees. And so now we come to the last real main section of Ephesians here, starting Ephesians 6, starting in verse 10, and running through verse 20. And then there's a short, just a three-verse final sort of ending to the book. So this last section is a really famous section. When you think of Ephesians, frequently this is the first passage that people, oh yeah, I remember in Ephesians, that's the full armor of God thing. And probably my favorite sermon on this is Charles Stanley. He gets very involved with it, and it's an excellent sermon. Charles Stanley's a very good preacher, and whatnot. And I've heard this preached a lot, and I've preached on this passage. And I actually take a slightly, not radically different view, but I take a slightly different view of it. So as we go through this, hopefully you guys weren't hoping to hear exactly how you put on the helmet of salvation or exactly what are the shoes of the gospel. But I take kind of a different view. And my view on this, just to sort of warn you ahead of time so you can run screaming for the exits or turn off the computer at this point, if you're on the internet, and you're probably playing solitaire anyway while you're listening to this online. So, but my take on this is what Paul was doing was Paul's point was that he wants to tell us about the power of God, and specifically about how God is, you know, Messiah is coming back, and he's angry and he's taking names, you know, and he's coming in power and glory, and he is going to right the wrongs, and that we are part of that. We're there in the army behind Messiah, and we're powerful as well because of God. And part of this is Paul uses the imagery of a Roman soldier, the Roman soldier's battle gear. And I think that, I really think Paul is focusing here on that power of God and how, you know, there is this cosmic, and I don't mean it in a New Agey sense, but there is a cosmic war between God and Satan. And you know, there's two armies. You can be God's army or you can be Satan's army. You can't be both. And that the power comes for us recognizing that we're in God's army. And that this use of the imagery of the Roman soldier's battle gear is just something Paul uses to make his point. It's not the focus of this. And I think that I was actually talking to my son before I came up here tonight. He was asking me what I was teaching and how I was going to do it, blah, blah, blah. And I said, you know, I think if Paul showed up today, he would say, wow, that's pretty cool what you guys have put all this focus on, the breastplate and the shoes and the helmet and the sword and all this stuff. I mean, that's really cool. I was kind of going for a bigger picture, but that's okay too. And hopefully, you know, when we all get to heaven, Paul won't go, oh, by the way, John, you completely missed my point. I was focusing on the shoes. So I want to kind of take that tack tonight. I don't want to focus on these individual pieces. I want to talk about the what I think Paul was saying in the larger context here. I differ a little bit in some of this with the commentary that I've recommended for this class, with Honer's commentary. Again, you know, actually, if you're going to choose, you know, Honer's a bigger name. He's a smarter guy. Well, he's deceased now. Godly man. You know, so you can, if you choose, well, do I listen to John or do I read Honer? Well, you always go with Honer. He's a bigger name. But I think my position is pretty good, too. So I think what Paul does in verse 10, Paul gives us the thesis statement for the last section of this book. Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. That's Paul's key statement there. Okay? Just like he's, you know, throughout the book, he's given us thesis statements, right? In the very first verse, or the very first chapter, he said, you know, we're to, blessed be God, right? Well, why is he, because of, he's blessed us, and he gives all that. He said that, that in the beginning of this second half of the book, for us as believers, we're to what? We're to walk as believers, we're to be meek, gentle, and patient. Right, that was his thesis statement. Then he, you know, he gives us sort of his thesis statement in chapter 5, verse 21, subjecting yourself to one another in the fear of God. And then he goes on to explain it. So I think that here he's given us this statement. Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and power of his might. That's the point. He could stop there and we'd be fine, but Paul doesn't. He goes on to expand on this. So now he tells us, he says, okay, here's how you do that, okay? In verse 11, put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. Okay? So his main statement is that we're to be strong in the Lord. And he says the way you do that is you put on the full armor of God so you can resist. Now, he tells us the reason why we need to do that. So he tells us what he wants us to do. He gives us a brief explanation of how. And then he tells us why. We have to put on that full armor of God to resist the devil. Why? Verse 12. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, powers, against the rulers, the darkness of this age, against the spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. So that's the reason why we have to put on this full armor of God. Now that should be our first tip here. He tells us we don't wrestle against flesh and blood, but against these spiritual forces. So that should tell us that we probably don't need to go out and craft a breastplate and a helmet and a shield and a sword and shoes to wear. That's probably, if we're battling in the spiritual realms, we probably don't need special physical gear to do this, right? We do not need special undergarments, as some churches teach that you need. The LDS Church, I don't know if you guys know, but the LDS Church, good Mormons wear special undergarments. My wife calls it magic underwear, and they have symbols on them to remind them of purity and strength and whatnot. But a good Mormon will always wear these special undergarments.
Catholics have these things that they wear under their clothes.
Actually, interestingly enough, Catholics have something called the scapula, which is an interesting thing. Now, I'm getting slightly off track here, but I don't mean to bash any of these folks. This is not meant to bash Mormons. This is just to say this is a practice of theirs. I had a friend in college who was Mormon. He did his mission as a young man down in the South, and a bunch of kids from the local Southern Baptist actually broke into a room where he was staying, and they took his and his other missionaries that found their sacred garments and took them and put dirt all over them and mocked them and held them up. And this group of young Southern Baptist kids just loved mocking them over this. And to me, that's wrong. You can discuss theologically, but you just don't act in that manner. That's not meek, gentle, and patient behavior. But anyway, the Catholics have this thing called a scapula. Now, it's actually a little picture on sort of like felt, and it's held together by two sort of... The material is usually looks like this... you know, in your Bibles, you have these sort of silk ribbons, you know? Really good Bibles have silk ribbons. A lot of my Bibles have just stickies. But the real good ones give you these rhythms. And the ribbons, synapses are not firing this evening. The ribbons are attached to these two little pictures on felt. And it's sort of put over your neck, and one little picture is held in front, one little picture is held in back. And they usually have a picture in like an icon of a particular thing. It could be the Sacred Heart of Jesus. Catholics do a devotion to what's called the Sacred Heart of Jesus. Normally there's a picture, a religious picture of Jesus looking quite Northern European in most of them. For a little Jewish boy, he looks a lot more like Robert Redford than he should. And you'll see his heart is sort of there with a crown of thorns around it, a little flame. And it's a devotional practice. The Catholic Church and Eastern Orthodoxy, quite frankly, they have icons and whatnot, use things, and they're used as devotional tools. They're used as religious objects to help them to think about or to pray or to worship. This is a concept that's hugely foreign to those of us in the Protestant camp, because we don't have any of this stuff, right? But and they call them sacramentals. they believe that these go beyond just mere objects to things that have a level of intrinsic spiritual value to them. Now, and I know there are a lot of people that would disagree with this statement. In my opinion, that at that level, there's nothing fundamentally wrong with it. Where it's bad is it opens the door up to the practice of magic. And in religion, we have to make a strong differentiation between religion and magic. A religion, in the broader scope, the sociological scope, religion is the human beings interacting with some sort of spiritual practice and structure. And it's a god or multiple gods or whatever. And it's that interaction. Magic is the attempt by humans to manipulate their environment that's out of their direct control. Now, where that lapses over in religion is that you use your religious practice to manipulate these gods to give you what you want. I mean, it's very easy to see in what we would call pagan societies. You know, you have a statue that's your god, and you go up and you offer fruit to it, or you burn a fire, or you kill something, or you do all this stuff because you're trying to definitely appease that god so that your crops come in, or it doesn't rain, or you know, you don't die of illness. So that's like, and we're pretty easy with that. Now, where it starts to get weird is that we all do the same thing in our own religious practice. I mean, I'll tell you, I still have to watch myself to do this. I'll think, boy, I really want this from God. You know, here's something I can't do on my own. I want to avoid a test, or I want to make sure my cholesterol goes down, or whatever. And so I start making these deals with God. Okay, God, I need you to do that. I need you to lower my cholesterol. I promise that I will go to Bible study every Wednesday night, and I'll give you 15% of my income, and I will not cuss at the TV news anymore in the evenings. I promise I'll do that, God, if you just lower my cholesterol. Okay, that's magic. Okay, what I am trying to say, I will do certain things that will then manipulate the religious deity to give me favor. Okay, and we all do that. Some of us do it in a grander scale than others. Okay, and the problem with these religious items that the Catholic Church uses is, instead of being a reminder to pray or to you know, look to God for some, they become magic little amulets. And so I wear this to protect myself from, you know, spiritual evil or bad things. You know, I got to tell you, you see it all the time in Protestantism on the cable TV channels, where if you send the guy $10, he sends you the prayer cloth with the miracle healing oil on it, and that's magic. That's not religion. Christianity is a religion based on relationship. We are in relationship. Honest to God relationship, in the same way that we have a relationship with our wife or our children or our husbands or our best friends, that's the same relationship we have with the supreme being of the entire universe. We have a relationship with God. And so I wouldn't carry a magic penny to make sure that my wife, you know, always made sure I, you know, had gas in my car or something. And I wouldn't carry a magic medallion to make sure that God favored me, because that's not what a relationship is. It's not magic. But the problem with these items, these religious items, is they push over into magic, and they push over into idolatry. I mean, that was the big battle back in, it started in the 7th century? 8th century? In Christianity, it was the battle between the iconodules and the iconoclasts, and it was in the Eastern Church. The West sort of stayed out of it, but... Well, they didn't. They actually meddled in it, and that's what caused part of the beginning of the split between East and West. But in the Byzantine Church, they were arguing over religious icons, right? Pictures. And the iconodules were the folks who said, no, these are good. And we should have these up on our walls, and we should use them as focuses of prayer, and there's nothing wrong with them. And the iconoclasts, we still use that term today for people that go against things that are thought to be important and sacred, the iconoclasts said, no, you have to get rid of them. That's idolatry. That's forbidden by the Bible. And the iconodules said, no, this is exactly what God did. God, who is formless, became human. He created an icon of himself in Jesus Christ. And that's, so this is perfectly okay. And they battled over this for a long time. I mean, a couple hundred years. They fought it out. And they finally decided that it was okay to have these pictures. Western Church always had statues and pictures. It wasn't until the Reformation that Luther was okay with it at first. Calvin got a little iffy. By the time you get out to Zwingli and some of the other guys, boy, they literally went in and destroyed pictures and statues and everything that were up in churches because that was idolatry. You have to be careful if you get too extreme on that. But so this has always been a battle. So anyway, point being here, back to the Paul's letter, is that if this battle is spiritual, then I don't need to wear special created things because it's a spiritual. He uses the imagery of the full armor of God, and I'm going to explain that in a minute. What I think why he does that, but he says that's the reason. So his statement is that we have to be strong in the power of the Lord. And how we do this is we put on the armor of God, and the reason why we do this is we're battling against principalities, powers. And then he just recaps again in verse 13. Therefore, take up the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand in the evil day, having done all. Okay, so that's the first chunk here. Verse 10 is the statement, and then verses 11, 12, 13, and 14 is Paul's explanation of how we do that. And then he starts over here in verse 14. And verse 14 through verse 20 is, again, it's the last of the big sentences. Remember I told you in Ephesians you have these huge sentences, yep. 1 through 14, all these things. Well, here's the last one of those in the book. Verse 14 through 20 is all one big, gigantic sentence. So as we're looking what Paul's saying, we have to understand this is not separate verses like we have it in our Bibles. We have to say, okay, well, how did Paul, if that's one big sentence, you know, where's the subject? Where's the verb? Where's the subclauses and all this stuff? So then we look at that. And then finally, verses 21 through 24 are Paul's final last little sort of signature on the piece. So that's the structure. I want to walk through it then now. Let's look at this first thing. Well, verse 10 is his main statement that we're to be strong in the Lord. Just repeats what he said two other times in the book. If you go back to chapter 1, verse 19... Paul, in his prayer, the prayer that he started in verse 16, Paul's prayer, I do not cease giving thanks for you, making mention of you in my prayer, content of the prayer, that God of our Lord Jesus Christ, Father of glory, give you the spirit of wisdom, revelation, that the eyes of your understanding be enlightened. And then in verse 19, chapter 1, verse 19, he says, and that you would know what is the exceeding greatness of his power towards us who believe according to the working of his mighty power. So Paul prays in the very first chapter of Ephesians that the believers would know what that mighty great power is, right? And then he defines what the power is in verse 20. This is what the power is. The power is that it's the same power which he worked in Christ when he raised him from the dead, seated in the right hand in the heavenly places. So Paul says he wants in chapter 1, his prayer is that the Ephesian believers, and by extension us, that we would know the mighty power of God. And what is the mighty power of God? It's the exact same power that God used to reanimate a dead human body. It's the power that God used to raise Christ from the grave. That's the power Paul wants us to know is working in our lives. Okay, go over to chapter 3. There's another prayer that Paul starts. In verse 14, right? He says, for this reason I bow my head. We get down to verse 20. He goes through this, to know the love of Christ, which passes knowledge, that you may be filled with all the fullness of God. Now to him who is able to do exceedingly abundantly above all that we ask or think, according to the power that works in us. Paul is saying again, God can do not just what we ask, not just what we're thinking about, but God can exceed above anything we can ask and anything that we can think for our good, and he does this through the power that works in us. It's the power he talked about in chapter 1. It's that power that raised Christ from the dead, that reanimated a human, dead human body. That's the power that works in us that can do more than we can think or can ask. Okay, so over here in verse 10, in chapter 5, Paul says, finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. So the strength that Paul is telling us is this huge power. It's that power that God used to raise Christ from the dead. And I keep telling people, this is you got to get this to understand this power, because we do this all the time. Oh, I did that in the power of the Lord. Oh, I got the power of the Lord. Paul wants us to understand the power of the Lord. Well, we've got to understand that's not just a word that we throw around. The power of the Lord is not just a euphemism for God's care. The power of God is a legitimate, real, actual power. And Paul tells us that's the power that physically raised Christ from the dead. I mean, that's right, that's what we believe as Christians. That a dead human body, and not just one that passed away gently, but a human body that was brutally beaten and murdered in a horrendous fashion, could be dead for 3 days and then be completely reanimated. Not just that he kind of swooned and fell asleep, or that he was hurting a little bit because he had a boo-boo on his knee, but he was dead for 3 days. That's the power Paul talks about here. And he defines it that way. That's not just me waxing on about how great God's power. That's what Paul says, right? So when he says this, he wants us, that's where we get our strength. We get our strength from that power. It's not that we're big and strong or smart or good-looking or fast or whatever. I'm none of those things, quite frankly. I'm smart. I'm not good-looking, fast, or strong. So, but you know, it's not saying that. It's saying that we get our strength from His power. Okay, so the extension of that then, verse 11, we put on the whole armor of God. Now, Paul was under house arrest up in Rome when he wrote this letter. Paul was well acquainted with the Roman military, okay? They'd arrested him. He saw him. Paul knew what the Roman military looked like. And so Paul is using an imagery there that would have been, everybody knew what the Roman military looked like. It would be like if Paul was here today writing this letter to the Irvinians, okay, to the church in Irvine. Paul's writing this letter and he says, you know, you guys have to be strong. You got to put on the battle gear of a Marine, or you got to put on the policeman's uniform to fight your battle. Because, see, we would all know, that would make sense to us, right? And if he talked about, you know, the policeman's uniform of power, well, if he said, okay, put on the gun belt of righteousness and carry the billy club of faith and have the handcuffs of salvation, right? Well, that would make sense because we know this stuff. We'd get the inference. We'd know, okay, I know what the billy club is. I know what the gun belt is. I get the handcuffs. That's for, you know, binding people, you know, and we'd get that. That would be an imagery we'd get. Somebody who isn't familiar with a modern-day policeman's uniform might not get that imagery, right? Somebody, you know, 2,000 years from now, who, you know, if the Lord tarries, we'll all be floating around looking like the Jetsons, right? They might not know what the billy club of faith is, right? So we would have to explain it. So 2,000 years from now, we're reading the billy club of faith. We'd have to say, what is that? Well, they'd say 2,000 years ago, policemen carried a big wooden stick that they used to thump on people who weren't doing what they wanted them to do because it was nicer than shooting them, right? And so we would explain that, right? Well, in the same way that now we look at this full armor of God and we say, okay, we kind of have to, I don't know what a Roman soldier looked like. So, okay, we have to explain that. So, but I think that level of detail, again, is missing the point of what Paul's trying to say here. But he uses this imagery of the Roman soldier, the full armor of God. And the reason for this is that if we have this, we can withstand against the wiles of the devil. Again, this is being strong in the power of the Lord. And then Paul says, and this is really important, this is not a battle of flesh and blood. Now, within this verse, starting in 12, the Greek here is important to look at. Okay, a couple of words. First of all, the word that, and I don't know what all different translations have, but that word about we do not struggle, our struggle is not against flesh and blood, that word struggle is actually the Greek word wrestle. Okay? And in most Greek literature outside of the New Testament, when you see that word, it talks about wrestle. It's hand-to-hand combat. It's not like, you know, back in I'm sure you guys have watched the Discovery Channel and the History Channel, and you know, when they fought wars, when Rome fought, they fought in what was called a phalanx, which was like a big square of people, okay? And you had, you know, I don't know the exact number, 20, 30 guys in this, and you all march shoulder to shoulder in, you know, let's say six guys in five lines. And the front line, they had big shields, okay, big shields, like, mm-hmm. you know, it'd come up to here. And so the front line of this group of six guys would all be side by side with these big shields, and they'd become fort. And then all the other guys would be behind them, and they would have swords, or they might have lances that they would drop out, or sometimes they had archers, okay? And so, but they fought as a block, and so this big block was like a big human tank, okay? Now, that's how you fought. And it wasn't really hand-to-hand combat as you know, it was you moved in and you mowed down your enemy. And now, granted, as you got closer, yeah, you did have to, you would break ranks and you would have to sword battle with somebody. But you fought in these blocks of people. Rome was ingenious in this way, is that when they would conquer an area and they would add people into the army, they got people to intermarry. Because it made sense. If you're fighting in this phalanx, that, you know, you got your father-in-law on one side and your brother-in-law on the other, that's going to make you work really, really hard to make sure that your group of guys won. Because if you were just out on your own, you go, I'm out of here, and you bail, and these guys are left without one of their soldiers. So Rome was very smart on this. But this word here, wrestle, it's more like you're Bruce Lee, and you've got to battle with somebody one-on-one. Okay, you're not in this big group of guys. There's not five guys with a big shield in front of you. This word here for struggle is really that word wrestle. It's hand-to-hand combat. You're in there really battling. And the second thing that's interesting here is this preposition. He uses the preposition pros. Put on the full armor of God. So that there's pros there. Pros against the cunning statements of the devil. But the key use of pros is in 12. He says, because this is not with us our wrestle, right? That word struggle, pale there, wrestling, against pros, that word pros. Now, the word pros in Greek has a couple of different meanings. It can mean against. It can mean with. But it frequently means not just with, but face-to-face. Very close contact. John 1:1. Everybody knows that verse, right? That's the big Logos verse. That's
in the beginning?
Yeah. It's one of the baseball verses.
There you go.
In the big inning. And John uses this exact same Greek word there to describe the relationship between God and the Word, where it says in the beginning was the Word and the Word was with God. Mm-hmm. That's pros. And that means a very intimate, close relationship. Now, there it's positive. Here, I think Paul is using that intentionally to say this wrestling, this hand-to-hand combat that we're doing, is very close and personal. It is an intimate struggle with our enemy. It's not just standing back lobbing a rock over the fence. It's right up front, hand-to-hand combat, face-to-face with the enemy. So I think that the struggle here, Paul is clear saying it's not an intimate face-to-face struggle with flesh and blood. It's with these spiritual powers, but that it is an intimate face-to-face, hand-to-hand kind of battle. Okay? Because remember, this is the application section of this book. He's telling us that we are going to have a battle that we need to prepare for by standing in the strength of the power of the Lord, but that this battle is going to be hand-to-hand and face-to-face. Okay? Yeah?
Now, you're talking about in verse 12, right?
Correct.
Okay.
He uses pros twice. He uses that after pale, which is the struggle or wrestle.
Uh-huh.
He says pale pros, and then imakai sarka, which is blood and flesh, and then he has the conjunctive Allah, right? But pros against the arche, pros, tos. So he's using this word there, I think, to show that this is not just, well, yeah, life's going to be a little tough because Satan's stacked against us. I think Paul is letting us know we're going to have a real, and anybody that's lived their Christian life for more than about 6 months knows that he does. He uses it sometimes just to mean with. But I think in this particular case, tied to Pale there, he's trying to show that wrestling is a face-to-face, close wrestling. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's It's giving an overriding view of that. The pros before in verse 11, and I think the pros later in 12, we could just be as with. But I think particularly here, the way Paul structured it, with that word to wrestle or to struggle, I think he's trying to show where that struggle is. And the fact that it is a word that means hand-to-hand combat, I think Paul's emphasizing it. So he's saying that, look it, we have to do this. We have to put on the full armor of God. That's how we have our strength, because, gosh darn it, we're going to be in close hand-to-hand combat with our enemy. And it's not a physical enemy, it's a spiritual enemy. And he goes through this and gives you kind of all the places where this enemy is. Okay, it's the powers, the rulers, the darkness of this age. It's the spiritual hosts of wickedness in heavenly places. He's covering everything here. It's not just, you know, there's a demon around the corner hiding in the bush. He's saying that sort of the whole system that is spiritual. You're rooting for one of two teams. You're either rooting for God or you're rooting for Satan. And it's a big team that Satan's got. And it may be our world system. It may be an individual you can easily be tempted. It may be a physically oppressive movement against a local church. It may be, you know, there's a whole variety of things. But Paul says, look, the spiritual enemy is there. Okay? It could be a whole variety of things. My take on it is that two things about Satan attacking us. Destroy God and his program. Sometimes I think he gets way too much credit. And Satan is torch. Really our gift. So when we're talking enemies out, my opinion is when Satan comes after us, he comes after our weak spots, and he comes after us in a way that's very attractive to us. Because nobody wants to sin with ugly, yucky stuff. We only want to sin with the really good-looking, fun stuff, right? I mean, if we hated sin, it would be a lot easier to avoid it, right? But the sin in our lives is the stuff that we really go, that's pretty good stuff, you know? So he's talking about this. It's out there. All of this is out there. And he says, therefore, he repeats here, take up the whole armor of God. Now, this is interesting, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand, right? To remain standing. Well, what's this evil day? There's a lot of discussion of that. Some people think that it's the tribulation. It's out in the future. Well, if that's true, then we're lucky as a church, at least those of us that are pre-trib, because we ain't going to be around for it. So, you know, all heck can break loose. It can rain cats and dogs, and I won't be here, so I don't care. I think the evil day here is Paul is talking about our current day. For him, the current time when the Church of Ephesus was around, there was plenty of evil. And I think by application, us, we live in an evil world. I mean, you know, the people are writing letters saying that Roman Polanski should be let off the hook. And I mean, that's unbelievable to me. I mean, how do you do that? You know, and we live in an evil world. I mean, it's just there, right? And so our battle is against that. But I think also Paul is talking about those individual times where we are personally dealing with strong attacks and strong evil. You know, I'm not a big guy thinking that there's a demon in every room and Satan's jumping up and down for me, but I know there are particular times in my life that I can tell you Satan was throwing a lot of stuff at me because he was trying to derail what was happening at that point in my life, either for me being available to be used by God or something God was trying to do for me, and there are times. And so I think this evil day is both our general age that we live in, as well as those times for as believers where we have an extra strong sort of attack by Satan. Now I always tell people that you need to read over in Luke. I love this passage. It's where Jesus was tempted in the desert, you know, by Satan.
Okay.
Luke 3. Because frequently we think, all right, I've nailed it. Boy, I was really tempted to go over there and do that terribly bad, sinful thing, and I didn't. And, boy, thank goodness that's over. Now I can relax. And I love this because you got to look at the end of the temptation of Jesus here. Where is it? Okay. Maybe it was 4. Okay, Satan tempts Jesus. I'm sorry, in chapter 4, not chapter 3. Chapter 4, verse 13, right? Jesus has all his temptation, and Jesus nails it, right? He completely does not succumb to the temptation, and he gets done with it. And what does Luke say? Now, when the devil had ended every temptation, right, and he failed, he departed from him, not permanently, but until an opportune time would come. So in other words, Satan went, okay, I lost that one. But I'm going to catch you. I'll get you next round here, right? So we're never over the hump on this one, right? Now, the one thing about that past the temptation in the wilderness that I absolutely love, and this is, I did not come up with this, a real good friend of mine said this. He said that, you know, look at how did Jesus stop Satan, right? He didn't do his magic power. He didn't do anything. He quoted Scripture. And so Jesus defeated the face-to-face temptation with Satan by quoting Scripture, and it was Deuteronomy. And my friend always says, I would hate to think that I had to go into battle with Satan, and the only thing I had was my knowledge of the book of Deuteronomy to defend myself. You know, I'm thinking if I'm going in, yeah, I'm pretty good in Ephesians, I'm real good in Revelation, I could nail it with the Gospel of John. Ooh, Deuteronomy's all I have? Uh-oh, I'm at a loss here, right? So, but Jesus nailed it with Deuteronomy, so that was pretty good. So this idea of the evil day, it's not just once, we always have to be on guard. Okay, now we get into Paul, the second half of this, right, where Paul is going to unpack this full armor of God. He starts this section by saying, he ends verse 13. Therefore, take up the whole armor of God that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, having done all to stand. How does he start the next verse? Stand therefore. That's an important word. I want you to be able to stand. When the battle's done, you should still be standing, because we have to withstand the battle, right? So I want you to stand. Therefore, stand. Stand up, right? That's what Paul says. Notice, what's the big word Paul has used in the whole second half of this book? It's been walk. Now all of a sudden, he doesn't say walk around in the full armor of God. Paul says stand. That's an important word for Paul. That's it's not meaning that we have to stand up. But what Paul is saying there is you need to stand. You need to be strong. This is the power of God that you have to be strong in. Now, I think what Paul is saying here, remember, this is all one big sentence. I think that the way Paul wrote this, and I'm going to paraphrase Scripture for a minute. Stand, therefore, after you've done all this and put on the full armor of God, jump to verse 18, praying always with all prayer and supplication in the Spirit, being watchful to this end with all perseverance and supplication for the saints. In other words, I think what Paul was saying is he was saying, you need to be strong in the power of God. That's the overarching statement. How do you do this? You got to put on the full armor of God. Why? Because we don't battle against men. We battle against spiritual powers that are just out there after us all the time. Therefore, I want you to stand, praying always with all supplication, all thanksgiving to the Spirit. But Paul slips that in. I want you to stand, having put on the full armor of God, and pray always. See, the controlling verbs here, I think, are stand and pray. I don't think it's put on. I think the put on section is a subordinate clause idea to Paul's idea that we have to stand and pray, because our power is to be strong in the power of the Lord. Okay? So this whole section on the full armor of God that he unpacks, I think is a sub clause to this idea of that you stand and you pray and you're in the power of God. Okay? Does that make sense? You see what I'm saying there? Now, there are folks that disagree. Honer's commentary does not take this view of it. This happens to be what I think works here. It's not terribly heretical. It's not going to destroy Scripture if you take my view. I just think there's a different emphasis here.
What does Honer say?
Well, Honer actually says that you know, the verse 18 the follow-up out of 17, and that the division is based on, Honer makes the division, stand as the first one, and then take in verse 16. He makes the division of this section there. Stand, and then in 16, take the shield of faith, and then, coming out of verse 17, taking the helmet, then to 18, praying always. So he'll make the separation there. I take the second half of verse 14 through 17 as a subclause that I think what Paul is saying is we're to stand, praying always with prayer and supplication. That's what he tells us coming to 13. Okay. So, now, what about the full armor of God? Let me just tell you how I want to go tonight, just to let you know. I would like to not take our break, because I think I can get us done before 8:30, so we don't need to take our break, if you guys are okay with that. Okay. So, the full armor of God, what is it? Well, again, it's the imagery of a Roman soldier of the first century. But I don't think that's where Paul is coming from. I think the roots of this go back to the Old Testament prophecies of the coming of Messiah. And I think specifically it's coming out of Isaiah 59. And I think that this is a concept and an imagery that is consistent. You know, Paul was a good Jewish boy. Paul knew the Scriptures. They didn't have a New Testament when Paul was around. They were writing it at the time. So the Bible that they had, the Word of God they had, was the Old Testament. It was the words of the prophets, okay? And I think, and I'm trying to show here in a minute, that this is coming out of Isaiah 59. And that Paul just happened to use the contemporary imagery, but the driving force behind it was Messiah coming again to save the people, okay? Now, a couple things. One, Paul uses this imagery one more time. If you go over to 1 Thessalonians 5, he's talking about the day of the Lord. Okay, but concern starting in chapter 5 in 1 Thessalonians. But concerning the times and seasons, brethren, you have no need that I should write to you, for you yourself know perfectly that the day of the Lord so comes as a thief in the night. For when they say peace and safety, then sudden destruction comes upon them, as labor pains upon a pregnant woman, and they shall not escape. But you, brethren, are not in darkness, so that this day should overtake you. So Paul's setting up talking about the day of the Lord. So what does he say? He says, we're sons of light, sons of the day. We're not of night or darkness, right? We are to not sleep as the others do, but let us watch and be sober. For remember, those that sleep, sleep at night. those who get drunk are drunk at night, but here we go, verse 8. But let us who are of the day be sober, putting on the breastplate of faith and love, and as a helmet the hope of salvation. So there's the imagery Paul's using. But if we look at the difference, one, he leaves out the shoes and the sword and everything. But in Ephesians, he says the breastplate is righteousness. In Thessalonians, the breastplate is faith and love. The helmet in both cases is salvation. So there's a difference here. So the first thing that tells me is Paul's not locked into this imagery. Okay? Well, he's not, because he would have done it the same way. Paul uses the imagery when it's necessary in what he's teaching, but he's not locked into it. It always has to be the breastplate of righteousness, the shoes of the gospel of peace, right? Because he does it differently in 1 Thessalonians, and Paul wrote both of these letters. So Paul's somewhat inconsistent. He's using the imagery as he needs to for his talk. The other place, and these are the only two times he uses this imagery, notice it's in the context of preparing for the day of the Lord, right? Which is that great final, terrible battle, judgment, tribulation, end of the times kind of thing. And he's using that imagery in that context. He's not in Ephesians, but he is in Thessalonians. Does that make sense? Everybody tracking with me so far?
He's not talking about the second coming?
In 1 Thessalonians,
okay.
I think he is. In Ephesians, I think he's talking about how we live on a regular daily basis. Okay? But I think the imagery is coming from the idea of the second coming. 1 Thessalonians, clear. It's day of the Lord. He says that up front. And notice he shifts the imagery. The breastplate is not righteousness, it's faith and love. Okay? So, that's the first thing. Secondly, is that within the general thought, there's this idea of the second coming, not just this Jesus is going to show up as some sort of cosmic hippie from the 60s and we're all going to hold hands and sing Kumbaya and drink Coke, right? I mean, that's not the imagery of the Bible. That's not Jewish imagery of the end times. When the Lord comes back, he's serious. Remember, it's the God of hosts. The God of hosts means the God who's in charge of the armies. That word host means armies, right? I had a prof in, as an undergraduate, who was a very good Jewish guy, strong Zionist, right? And he joked that he always grew up and he heard the Lord of hosts when he was in synagogue and heard the readings, and he always thought it meant the person that throws a party, because his parents always talked about they hosted a party, you know? And so he always pictured the Lord of hosts as the guy who brings out the hors d'oeuvres. Can I fill your glass? Would you like something else to eat? And he said, he finally dawned him in, no, the Lord of hosts is the general of the army. He's the guy on the horse in front of the soldiers going, come on, right? So this imagery is a battle imagery, right? Okay, it was common in the first century, this kind of thinking. And I didn't bring the documents this evening, but if you read the documents from the Dead Sea Scrolls, the community there at Qumran that wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls, they had all this imagery of the good guy coming back. It was Messiah, right? It was the bringer of light, and it was this kind of imagery of a warrior wearing armor and whatnot, wearing a breastplate, wearing a helmet, coming in this final battle of good versus evil, and that was concurrent with this New Testament. Okay, that was a Jewish belief concurrent with Paul's time. The other thing is, and I'm going to do something that probably no other class at Hadavar will be doing tonight. I will be reading from an apocryphal book out of the Catholic Bible. So I just want to warn everybody, rescind all your giving. I know, I could be struck down right in front of you. The literature in the first century AD, and back before that, was this apocalyptic imagery. And it was in the Jewish consciousness, in that mindset. Now, there's a book called the Book of to Solomon. And in the Book of Wisdom, which is part of the Apocrypha, it's part of the agree should be in the Bible and Protestant, right? But if you read the Book of Wisdom, and if you're taking notes, Book of Wisdom says it's talking about God here. Okay, this is talking about God, not some made up God. They were writing about the God of Abraham, right? So this is, I don't believe it's canonical scripture, but I believe it is representative of good Jewish religious writing of the time. So he says, God, he shall zeal, he shall arm to punish the enemy. So here is God pictured as his zeal, his passion, God's desire to come back and rescue in Israel. That's what they're talking about here. His zeal is his armor, and he's going to get all creation to join with him to punish me. That's just for a breastplate, and for in where judgment helmet, holiness is shield, and when his sudden anger for a war with him against the foolhardy. So here's an imagery, the same kind of imagery of God coming back. This time God comes back with all of nature on his side. God wears this military stuff. There's a shield, there's a breastplate, there's a sword, there's a helmet. And notice that they use these metaphorical terms. His zeal is his armor. His breastplate is his justice. His judgment, his sure judgment, accurate, correct, righteous judgment will be his helmet. His invincible holiness will be his shield. His anger will be his sword. So here's more imagery that's coming out of this Jewish apocalyptic imagery that we see in Qumran. We see it in the early, in the Maccabean period, and later up to the time of Christ, a couple hundred years up to the time of Christ. We see this. We see Paul using a similar kind of imagery in Thessalonians when he's talking about the day of the Lord. I think it's inescapable not to say this had to color what Paul was talking about. So if we go now in the back to the real Bible, and go to Isaiah. And we go to Isaiah chapter 59. This is a section that's talking about Messiah. And God or Messiah, whoever you say at this point, says in verse 16 in chapter 59, he saw there was no man and wondered that there was no intercessor. In other words, he sees Israel in distress. And he says, there is nobody there. There is no mighty warrior like we had in the Judges period, right? There was no Gideon. There was no, there was nobody there to conquer. There was no David. There was nobody there to conquer, right? So God said, he saw there was no man and wondered that there was no intercessor. Therefore, his own arm brought salvation for him, and his own righteousness it sustained him. Here's the image of Messiah now. For he put on righteousness as a breastplate and a helmet of salvation on his head. He put on the garments of vengeance for clothing and was clad with zeal as a cloak. And according to their deeds, accordingly he will repay fury to his adversaries, recompense to his enemies, the coastlands he will fully repay. So they shall fear the name of the Lord from the west, his glory from the rising of the sun. When the enemy comes in like a flood, the Spirit of the Lord will lift up a standard against him. The Redeemer will come to Zion and to those who turn from transgressions in Jacob, says the Lord. Here's the imagery of God coming back and redeeming his people against the enemy. I just don't see how we can't see that picture. Even the words are the same here that we see in this section, this full armor of God. Paul is using the contemporary imagery of his day, as if I was using a policeman's equipment, right? But it's not about that. That imagery is just to help you get a word picture. Paul is coming out of this tradition of apocalyptic thought. This is God coming back to finally vanquish all the enemy, to conquer Satan, to destroy all of these things that aren't flesh and blood, but the principalities, the powers, the rulers, the darkness of this age. This is God coming back. And what are we to do? We're to stand with God. We're to put on that armor. That armor that Messiah comes back, that breastplate, that helmet, that shield, that sword, we're to engage that because Paul tells us up in verse 10, we're to be strong in the Lord and in his power. We're to put on that same power and garment that Christ will have coming back as Messiah to do the final battle. That's what we're to do. Right? Do you see what I'm saying here? That yeah, question.
John uses, I know, just to deviate a little
right.
John uses a similar imagery
uh-huh.
when he talks about Jesus coming back at the end of the tribulation
right.
period. He talks about, you know, on the horse and with the saints. And,
right.
And then he talks about the bridle, you know, the horse and stuff like that.
Right.
It's a similar imagery.
Yeah, it's exactly the same. John, and you're right, that's perfectly correct. Pointing out in Revelation, he talks about this, and it's this apocalyptic imagery, and it was so steeped in the Jewish thought that this is the imagery. And the reason why I bring this up is I think that we spend so much time in this passage talking about what our shoes shod with the gospel of peace, and we spend so much time on that I think we overlook the big thing that Paul is saying here. The reality is there's a battle with spiritual powers, and it's not flesh and blood. It is an ongoing battle that at times will be brutal and ugly, and we're right in the middle of it because we're in God's army. And the way we live is we put on the power of God. And then Paul is going to say, this is what that looks like. And people who would hear this would know Isaiah 59. They would probably have heard of the Book of Wisdom. They would know there are these crazy Jewish guys out in the middle of the desert living in caves that wrote this. They would understand this is the imagery. This is how Messiah is coming back. I mean, quite frankly, that's how they missed Messiah. Because Messiah didn't show up like this. Messiah showed up as a guy who said, no, no, no. This is what the Torah really is. They killed him. And they went, wait a minute, he died? So they missed Messiah the first time because they were and they got a right, but Messiah comes back saying that he's not suffering; he's back like this. And I think Paul is engaging that view, and so that's where we stand. That's the power we got to put on the same thing as when Christ comes back. He's got a helmet. He's got a breastplate. He's got a sword. He's coming back, and he's doing some serious damage on our behalf. We need to be the same way as we're battling our evil age and our individual temptations and trials. I think that's the big picture is talking about, not so much the focus on how do we shock. And again, there's nothing wrong with every morning. You know, Charles Stanley talks about in the morning before you get out of bed, think, I'm putting on my helmet of salvation. That's a great image. The helmet of salvation, it's protecting my brain. That's a great idea. My positional statement is that I am a saved believer, right? And I can't lose that. I am saved. That's how God sees me. So if I put on my helmet of salvation, it means that when Satan is attacking my brain going, hey, John, you're not a great guy. You got a lot of sin. You may not even be saved. You know what? I think God might even not pay attention to you because you got a lot of sin, John. Well, I can say, no, no, no. You're right. I'm a sinner, but I'm saved, and I know salvation. So intellectually, I got my brain protected. There's nothing wrong with doing that sort of thing with the full armor of God. But I think the point of what Paul is saying is a bigger picture. Paul is using this apocalyptic imagery to say, this is the final battle. This is how we need to gird ourselves in this. And this is what we have to do on almost a daily basis. Okay, then the final part of the letter here, the last part, verses 21 through 24, is just, you know, Paul's signing off. But he's interesting here. He mentions, I want to talk, the last thing here, is this guy Tychicus. Because Tychicus was a big deal, okay? He says in verse 21, but that you may also know my affairs and how I'm doing, Tychicus, a beloved brother and faithful minister in the Lord, will make all things known to you, whom I've sent to you for this very purpose, that you may know our affairs and that he may comfort your hearts. Remember I said back in the beginning of chapter 3, Paul was worried that when he said, I'm a prisoner on behalf of the Gentiles, that they would think, oh my gosh, he's in prison, and uh-oh, it's our fault. Well, I think that part of what Paul is saying here is, look, I've sent this guy Tychicus with the letter, and he knows what's going on, and you can ask him all the questions, and he'll give you the film at 11 kind of thing, right? Now, what's interesting is, and to me, I think this is proof that Ephesians was written by Paul and whatnot, because remember, there are some very liberal scholars that will tell you Ephesians wasn't. Colossians was written at the exact same time. If you go over to Colossians, the very end of Colossians, Paul uses almost exactly, word for word in the Greek, the same thing he says here at the end of Ephesians. He says in chapter 4, verses 7 and 8. In Colossians, Paul says, chapter 4, verses 7, Tychicus, a beloved brother, faithful minister, and fellow servant in the Lord, will tell you all the news about me. Well, back in Ephesians in 21, he said, But that you may also know my affairs and how I'm doing, Tychicus, a beloved brother and faithful minister in the Lord, will make all things known to you. It's almost the exact same statement. Verse 8 in Colossians 4, I'm sending him to you for this very purpose, that he may know your circumstances and comfort your hearts. Back in Ephesians 6, verse 22, speaking of Tychicus, whom I've sent to you for this very purpose, that you may know our affairs and that he may comfort your hearts. See, Tychicus was an important guy. Paul is up there in Rome, and he writes the letter to Ephesus, and I think that we don't know this. This is my conjecture. Paul writes four letters while he's up there, Philippians, Ephesians, Colossians, and Philemon. Okay, so he writes Ephesians, and he goes, okay, Tychicus, I'm going to have you take this down to him, but you know, I want to write a letter to the folks down at the other church. So he writes Colossians. And he the same way he ended Ephesians, he ended Colossians. He goes, look it, and I'm sending Tychicus down. And he says almost the same words, right? So they had to have been written at the same time, or whoever was working on one had to have the other one there. I mean, you just don't get that kind of lineup that close without the same guy doing it. And then he may have taken the other letters, but I know Tychicus took Ephesians and Colossians with him, right? Now, Tychicus was Paul praises him here. He calls Tychicus a beloved brother and faithful minister in the Lord. Tychicus is mentioned in the New Testament five times. And the first time it's in Acts 20, verse 4. Then in Ephesians 6, verse 21, 22. Colossians 4, 7, and 8. 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 12. And Titus chapter 3, verse 12. Paul uses Tychicus a lot. He sends him over to give Timothy a break, right? Gives Timothy a break, sends Tychicus in there. So when Paul says that he was a faithful brother, fellow servant, he's using Tychicus a lot. Now it's interesting, the postal service in Rome used to be that if I had something that I needed to send somewhere, I would dictate my letter, my amanuensis would write it, and I might sign the bottom of it or seal it or whatever, and then they would give it to the local mailman, okay? But he had a route, and he would take it only so far. He'd take it, you know, 50 miles, you know, and he'd hand it off to the next guy, and he'd say, okay, this has to go to Ephesus. And the guy'd say, okay, Roger, got it. And then he'd give it to the local guy, and he'd put it with all the other stuff that had to go down to the Ephesus region, and it would go maybe another 50 miles. And then another guy would take it. And they did this courier sort of thing, and it was kind of like the, you know, you had each little route. And then, so by the time it got to the end guy, the guy that brought you the letter probably wasn't the same guy, unless you were in the same little zip code. It could be 2, 3, 4, 5 different guys. And so you'd say, oh, this is great. This is a letter from this guy. Well, how's he doing? What's he doing? I don't know. I just deliver this route, right? Typical, you know, postal employee, right? Nah, postal employees are great. So he wouldn't know because just he wasn't there. He was like the third or fourth guy. He was just delivering that local thing. And it made sense. I mean, administratively, that's how you run it, right? You don't have one guy run 200 miles. You have one guy run 50 miles, right? By the time of Paul's time here, first century, Rome had changed how they did it. They actually went back to the one guy, one letter sort of system. So the advantage here, Paul was just copying what they would normally do in Rome, right? Remember, he's in Rome. You give it to one guy, because now that one guy, when he showed up, he could tell everybody, oh, let me tell you how Paul's doing. And then when he went back, he could tell Paul, let me tell you how they're doing down there in Ephesus. So Tychicus was that one guy. And he was a very important guy. If you look at those different citations there in the New Testament, you see that Paul relied on him. Tychicus was from Asia, so he was probably familiar with Ephesus and that region. He was one of the guys that went with Paul after the silversmith's riot. So he was familiar to Ephesus. He was probably familiar to the folks at the Colossian church as well. So Paul used this guy and praised him heavily. because he was the one that, while Paul couldn't get to them, he was the one that took the letter, brought it down there, and could say, you know, it's like a missionary coming in, right? And let me tell you what's going on, right? So Tychicus was a really important guy, even though he just gets mentioned at this one little spot. He's in five other times, and every time it's a key component of Paul's ministry. Yeah.
I guess that's why when you read Paul's letter, like, he'll say, you know, I heard about, like, say, when he wrote to the Corinthian church.
Right.
You know, I heard how you guys are doing, or when he wrote to the Roman church, the church in
right.
Rome. You know, I heard how you guys are doing. It was probably because of that one person that was running back and forth delivering the letters.
Exactly. Paul could, and Paul knew, right? He would, you know, Philippians, you had the two gals fighting down there at that church, right? He knew about that. Eudia and Syntyche. You know, the, in Philippians. I know that's a shock that you'd have two good godly women arguing about something in a church, but, where is it? Where is it?
Is it in Philippians or Acts?
I thought it was in Philippians. Here we go. Chapter 4 in Philippians. There, verse 1. Therefore, my beloved and longed for brethren, my joy, my crown, so stand fast in the Lord. I employ Euodia and I implore Syntyche to be of the same mind in the Lord. And I urge you also, true companion, help these women who labored with me in the gospel. So apparently we got a couple of gals arguing over, you know, whether they have roses or you know, pansies at the church supper on the tables, right? And Paul is saying, chapter 4, verses, I started in 1, but they're mentioned in 2, and 3, he's saying, look, help these gals resolve their difference. So Paul knew what was going on in these churches, right? So there would have been some interaction, and I think it was probably somebody like Tychicus that he was using to do this. But I always like to make sure Tychicus gets mentioned, because the poor guy shouldn't be an asterisk in New Testament history. You know, he was working his tail off, man. He's running between Rome and Ephesus, you know, and to help out. So, okay, well, that finishes Ephesians. Hopefully that was good for you guys and you got something out of it. I would strongly recommend that you, if you haven't gotten Honer, that you get it and read through it. It's an excellent commentary. It parallels a lot of stuff that we did in here, and there may be some parts that don't parallel, but it's really good. Now, coming up in the winter, in January, it's going to be How to Interpret the Bible. So I'm going to, and that'll cover all kinds of stuff. It'll talk about how the Bible came to be, you know, how it was written, how we know that we have an accurate version, how we know our translations are good. We'll talk about how we understand, you know, how we approach the Bible. Is the Bible literal? Is it an allegory? Do we spiritualize it? And well, I just tip my hand. I believe in the grammatical, historical method of understanding the Bible. In other words, we understand the Bible to say the words of the Bible in what the original authors meant by those words. That's how we understand it. Which means we understand narrative to be narrative. We understand allegory to be allegory. We understand poetry to be poetry. And then the historical context, we understand the Bible within its cultural context. Kind of like my discussion of Ephesians tonight is within the cultural context of the day. And so that'll be how, we'll talk about the hard sayings in the Bible and all those kind of things. So it'll be a way to really how to read the Bible, how to interpret, how to understand the Bible kind of class.
When is your Bible history?
That follows. When we're done with How to Interpret the Bible, which will probably be 10 to 12 weeks, then after that, the next class will be church history, starting from Acts and moving up through the modern period. Although it'll be a whirlwind, because to cover 2,000 years in, you know, 12 to 15 weeks, it'll be blowing our hair back. We'll be going so fast. But so that'll be the class that comes after the How to Interpret the Bible class. The How to Interpret the Bible class is good for folks who, if you know folks that are just new Christians, mm-hmm. I always like to have them because it gives them a good foothold, but it's also good for all of us old Christians, not chronological, but have been Christians for a while, because it's occasionally good to go in there and say, oh, okay, you're right. I need to understand that when the Bible says that God will hold me under his wings, that he's not some, that God isn't a big bird, that this is an allegory, but that I also need to understand that it's meant that way because it's poetic imagery, but I don't apply that same thing to the passage that says Jesus rose from the dead because that's historical narrative. So it helps us to really kind of make sure we know that. And then I always try to throw in a little bit how the Bible was written and how we got the Bible and that stuff, because that isn't covered a lot of times. Folks don't... I talked a little bit in this class when I talked about how we got the Greek text a while back. I'll do sort of a broader range of that, talking about the Old Testament as well. And that starts in January. So everybody have a good holiday. And I will see you all in January.